Well, my name is Tim Hamilton, and I'm the executive director of Otto, which is a nonprofit trade association of gasoline dealers who operate about 500 gasoline stations and convenience stores in Washington State. And I work as a petroleum consultant for that group and for other consumer groups across the country.
And how long has your organization been going?
Since 1984.
And you used to be a gas station owner yourself?
Yes. I operated gasoline stations for with Exxon and then Shell and finally Union 76 from 1974 to 1985.
And what prompted you to get out of that business?
Well, in 1984, I became very disturbed at the way oil companies were treating their franchise gasoline dealers, a local Chevron dealer, Arco dealer, Texaco dealer. And so did some of the members of the legislature, and they contacted me because my station was in the state capitol and asked me to educate them on what was going on. And in that process, it led to me as a grassroots lobbyist passing a Landlord-Tenant Act called the Gasoline Dealers Bill of Rights in Washington. It was a very animistic, volatile relationship developed between me and the oil companies. They didn't like me talking to the media or to the legislature, so I decided I wasn't going to be dealer of the year for a long time to come, so I left the active running of the service stations and continued on down that path, helping others, and have done so since that time. So for the last 25 years, I've studied the oil companies and helped a lot of government agencies from the FTC to the California Attorney General, the Washington Attorney General, Department of Energy, and so on, and a lot of state governments in trying to figure out what is causing price spikes and things like that in the marketplace.
And how do you go about getting your information?
Well, a lot of information is publicly available. A lot of information will come from third-party intelligence groups that specialize in petroleum intelligence. An awful lot comes directly from players in the industry who are affected. And then every now and then we will have situations where employees of the companies themselves will provide us internal documentation and things either that way or through court proceedings where we get a hold of internal documents to help educate us and document what's going on as well.
Well, I'm wondering if we can go into more detail about some of the things that you have found over your years working on this issue. The thing that originally brought attention of your work to me was an article in the Seattle Times talking about a memo from Shell that dealt with a local refinery in Anacortes. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Recently, Shell announced it was closing the Bakersfield refinery. And in conjunction with a consumer group that I've consulted with in California, we wrote an op-ed in the, it was published in the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle. And we argued that this refinery was being closed and it would further short the market and that Shell would divert fuel from Anacortes, Washington refinery down to California to make up for that closure. And that would short us as bad as California and we would all rise up to California prices. And further in 2004, it would be disastrous for us out here. And in their argument, they were out of crude oil in the San Joaquin and that this refinery was unprofitable, just could not be, because of the real high prices out west showed our calculations these refineries were one of the most profitable in the world. And after that, employees of Shell Oil contacted me and complimented us on the editorial and said that we were absolutely right. And my next response was, prove it. And they did. And they provided internal documents from the company that showed that the statements from Shell about lack of crude, about lack of profitability, were just simply not true. It also provided us with the refinery margins of all the Shell refineries in the United States, and we could look at the level of refinery margins in California and in Puget Sound and compare that to, say, Texas and Delaware, where their other refineries were, and we saw that the difference in pump prices out here were, in fact, not cost of doing business, but simply higher levels of refining profits for the companies themselves. So the argument that the price went up in the West was OPEC or environmental rules or regulations was, in fact, directly contradicted by their own internal document, which we have found through history that people representing the oil companies will come in and make statements in the public arena and the legislature and things, and then turn around and review documents they produce themselves that show exactly the opposite.
It's just been my impression from when I'm reading articles and, you know, watching TV, that tends to be when the prices go up, they have oil industry people saying, oh, it's OPEC's fault, and then they'll get some coverage of somebody at the pump saying, yeah, gosh, the gas prices are pretty high, and they never seem to go into any detail of the oil industry itself and what they do to manipulate the prices.
Well, this is a common frustration that I have, too, and the oil industry has spent literally billions of dollars with some very talented people to... which in most times is the purpose is to educate the public, is what an industry does. And in fact, I believe it's designed to confuse issues and confuse the public and elected officials. And in fact, there's been court rulings that in the Western United States, that's exactly what they do. They intentionally, I think a federal judge referred to it as lying, and they become misleading. And if you say black is white often enough, then people start repeating it, and pretty soon black is black, you know. And I run into that problem. And by the same token, there is, which I find to be truly amazing, that you could have a thing like gasoline and diesel and oil that affects our health, our public safety, and our economy so dramatically, and there is literally nobody out there who analyzes it and is prepared to speak to the issues other than the oil companies themselves. And I find that to be really amazing. It kind of, in a way, it brings me to the top as the go-to guy in the United States on these issues, because there's such a void where there's nobody else out there to do it. And the problem is that this takes resources and it takes money and it takes effort and it takes years of studying. And the only way you can get paid to do that type of thing, so to speak, is if you work for the oil companies.
Talk about some more about the evidence that you have dug up that would point to the oil companies, oil consortiums manipulating prices.
There's a couple of good examples. The best example that I think that I've uncovered that was very simple was in 1997. We went through a price spike in the Western United States, and prices went up from 14 to 25 cents a gallon across the West. And there was no refinery fire. The price of crude oil had gone down. OPEC wasn't in the headlines. There was nothing that could explain this price spike. And there was no, basically, excuse to hide behind. And what I did is I went out and tracked cargoes of ships. And the oil companies, numerous ones of them, loaded up our gasoline supplies and put it on ships out of Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Puget Sound, and exported it across the world, Argentina, South America, where prices were much lower than ours. And so they took our available gasoline supplies and actually exported them out of here. And I published what was called the Parade of Ships, and I identified the ships, the names of the ships, and the companies that had them. And it was ironic that the tanker Kenneth Durr, which is named after the then CEO of Chevron, was clearing Golden Gate Harbor with gasoline, and Chevron announced that there was a shortfall, and the oil companies did too, and they raised the price of gasoline 14 to 15 cents a gallon. And there was a prime example of supply and demand. We had a demand. We were getting ready to go into the spring drive time. The supplies were sufficient enough to supply our needs, and the price wouldn't go up, so they loaded up the gas and they shipped it out of here.
And when you reported this, did that get good media coverage?
Not nearly as much as I would have hoped it would have gotten. One of the problems we ran into was that, ironically, a lot of the media, when they see things like this, they'll go to the oil companies and seek confirmation, and the oil companies refused to talk to them. So a lot of media didn't cover it because they couldn't get confirmation, and I always thought that was kind of interesting. It's sort of like asking a bank robber, in my mind, to confirm that he robbed the bank. But the oil industry is very good and has a lot of PR people out there, and sometimes the story is difficult to tell on TV because they want to do it in a 1 or 2 minute at most bleep. So we often come back and have people in the media say, geez, you know, this is a great story, this needs to be told, but it doesn't fit our format. And ironically, where we seem to get the best explanation of it is on radio, where they have talk radio shows and things where they can go into it in depth. But one of the problems with this is you have a billion-dollar institution out there of trade associations and public relations firms and think tanks that are financed by the oil companies whose job it is to go in and make sure negative press doesn't appear.
Have you noticed any change of climate in the coverage with the current administration in power since it's been acknowledged that so many of the people at the top have oil connections?
Well, yeah. We've seen a lack of involvement by the Federal Trade Commission and different regulatory authorities in pursuing these matters. The current administration took the position with electrical crisis that in California, as an example, it will let the marketplace float and let prices rise to control consumption, which is what the oil companies do. So there's not a, while ironically gasoline has become a very big part of the current presidential campaign, we haven't seen any interest at the federal level other than, you know, campaign rhetoric on both sides.
Something else that had been in the Seattle Times article that I thought was interesting was you had done some work with bringing forth the revelation that I believe it was ARCO had closed down half their refineries in the 1980s. Is that correct?
Well, in 1982, yeah, this is a process that's been underway for a long time. And you remember, if you go back to 1974 when I entered the business and we were in gas lines, they went under federal controls and they were there till 1981 when we decontrolled the oil industry. And in 1982, ARCO formed what was called an SPU, a strategic planning unit, that wrote up a bunch of position papers and documents and things that I became aware of that spelled out they were going to blow up their credit card and vacate the ranks of the major oil companies and target unbranded independents who were causing competition between the refiners. And they also identified that we had a surplus of refinery capacity in the West. And if they went down and targeted these independents with their stations, they would be able to remove them, and then there would be no customers to buy gas from for outside competitors. And if they closed the refineries down to meet the needs, a quite acceptable period of profitability would ensue, as they called it. Now, the key was to get into the control of their service stations, and that's where all of me and my friends and my cohorts were, and they described how they were going to raise their rents and things and vacate the dealers and company operate them so that they could target the pump price and control the pump price. That's what led me to be interact with the legislature. Of course, all the time they were doing this in 1984, 1985, the same people who were writing up these plans to do this were testifying in Olympia that we were not telling the truth and none of this was going on. Well, subsequently in 1988, the Nevada legislature subpoenaed these documents and ARCO refused to turn them over, so they cited them with contempt. And then they turned over their little lawyer from Reno to go to jail for them, and under the threat of arresting the board of directors and the CEO of ARCO, ARCO turned them over in a negotiated settlement behind closed doors where they only let two members of the legislature look at them, and they doctored the documents, removed pages from it, taped across paragraphs, things like that, and turned it over that way. And unbeknownst to them, the day before, I'd gotten the entire document out of the court case, and I released it publicly, and their argument at that time was that they were confused, that they didn't know which copy the legislature wanted, the doctored one or the real one. So that what that document does today is it shows that the intentions of closing the refineries down to barely meet our needs was a plan that ARCO recognized that was going to be used by the other companies in them from 1982 forward. And they, in fact, did just exactly that, closed them down. We've also had documents released through Senator Ron Wyden that were originally came out in the court case in California. And Senator Wyden of Oregon published them. These are internal memos that describes how their lobbying teams are massaging environmental laws and rules and regulations to ensure that the smaller companies, in fact, can't build refineries and end up with their refineries closed and remain closed. And there's this public perception that the move to environmentally clean fuels was responsible when, in fact, who massaged those things to make sure it limited competition was the large oil companies themselves. So those are all part of this process that's evolved in the West that is now moving eastward, where we pay a heck of a lot more money for gasoline than anybody else, and it's all refinery profits. And this is a game plan that, like I say, has been underway since 1981.
Focusing on the small station owners, are they pretty much at the whim of the company, the corporation, whose logo they have on the sign as to what prices they're going to charge?
Indirectly, yes, and directly, no. If you go to a branded station, you can have a branded station that's operated by an independent merchant, and then you can go down the road a little ways and you'll find one that's operated by the company directly themselves, where they control the retail price completely at the company off. Well, you won't be able to tell the difference hardly between the stores, but other than the ownership papers. So the public can't tell the difference between one and the other a lot. But what happens is that the independent merchants are free to mark their gasoline up in a price margin to recapture their cost and to make a profit in a way they see fit. But that's on paper. But when the oil companies control your wholesale price and you have to buy all your gasoline from that one source of supply and nowhere else, and the contracts say they will charge you whatever they wish in their sole discretion, and there is no negotiation period. So when the oil companies go out and raise your price 20 or 30 cents a gallon, you have no choice, but it forces the pump price up. And the retailer typically relies on from 5 to 9 cents a gallon in regular unleaded for a margin that, if he's lucky, gets back his cost of the pumps out there. He basically sells gasoline at cost or below his actual cost of delivery in hopes of selling you Twinkies or fixing your tires or whatever. So the margin that the independents have is so small and so tight that it doesn't really reflect the differences in pump prices. Now, as an example, someone who went into Bellevue and saw a price of $2.05 and then went back to Tacoma and saw a price of $1.90 for the same brand station, they would assume that the dealer is in Bellevue is making more money than the dealer in Tacoma, and that's not necessarily the case, because the oil companies will charge up to, in fact, we documented it as high as 46 cents a gallon in different prices for the same company to two stations sitting the same distance from the truck loading terminal. So that's called zone pricing. So the oil companies go out and basically to the dealers wander around and they say, well, the price is worth $2.05 in Bellevue today, so we'll charge them $2. Well, the price in Tacoma today is $1.90, so we'll charge them $1.85. And they regulate our margins and they regulate our profits, and they're the ones that, in essence, have indirect, if not complete direct, control of the pump price. So we're pretty much at the whim of the companies, and there's not a lot we can do about it.
How much warning do you get when they're changing the prices on the gas?
Well, we get warnings that can be midnight tonight, or most likely we'll get the warning after it happens. We've actually had oil companies come in and deliver us gasoline and then turn around and raise the price after it's already at the station. And one more time, if you don't like it, you can get out of the business. There's no discussion, there's no negotiation, there's no apology, there's just a sneer.
Clarify something for me, if you would. I had thought I had read a ways back an article saying that the large gas companies swapped shiploads of oil on a moment's notice or whatever, so that, let's say, a tanker carrying ARCO oil could either go to a Shell facility or refined gas coming out of an ARCO facility could go off to one of their competitors' stations. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah. The oil companies will jointly go in and develop oil in joint ventures. They'll produce it together. They'll send it down a pipeline like Valdez. where they own the pipeline in the partnership, and then the oil comes out, and the companies will sell it back and forth to each other, and it'll arrive at different refineries. And sometimes the ownership of the oil will change hands two or three times as it's moving from Valdez to here. And then once it's made into gasoline at a refinery, the gasoline is like, if you think of it like going to, you know, to buy paint at a hardware store, its base is the same. It's called MoGas, and it's generic and fungible, and the oil companies fill all the tanks up with all their gas, and they share it a lot in the same storage tank. So when the truck pulls up to fill up, it swipes a card just like you do on a card reader at the pump, and that card tells it, oh, this is going to be Arco truck, and it subtracts the volume from their share of the shared tank, and then it fills up with gas, and then at the last minute it goes just like the color in paint, in goes the Arco additives, and that makes it Arco gas. And then the next truck pulls up, and it's Chevron, and they swipe a Chevron card, and the way it goes again.
So the difference then would be in the additives that each company squirts in there at the end.
That's correct.
And I would imagine those would be protected formulas, kind of like Kentucky Fried Chicken's 11 herbs and spices.
Sort of, but not quite. DuPont Chemicals makes most of the additives, a lot of the additives, and in one of the first environmental movements we had, initiatives that we had in gasoline, was to make sure that they had a certain motor fuel quality that made certain standards, and that the additives, which is most of the cleansing additives, were reached a certain standard and a certain quality so that it would keep engines cleaner, so the cars wouldn't pollute and smoke as much. So one company will buy its additive from another or share it back and forth, and it depends on what part of the country you're in and what brand you're talking about, but there is no secrets in the additives. The other companies know what each company blends, and sometimes they blend similarly the same thing or exactly the same thing.
Well, that brings up another question, too, as to the difference in gas prices between companies.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, again, that you can go down any street, USA, and one particular station on one side of the street will have a price that can be 5, 10, 20 cents difference from a competing station across the street. What's going on with that?
Well, again, there's a substantial difference in the wholesale prices that are charged by the companies themselves. Now, a lot of it has to do with what we call brand value. Now, let's take ExxonMobil as an example. Exxon has got a very limited presence up here because it pulled out years ago, and there are Exxon dealers up here and Exxon distributors that are supplying Exxon stations. But they have a very small market share, and they have a very small credit card base for Exxon proprietary credit cards. So they, if they come up to match Chevron, which has a higher image, more stations, and so on, their volume falls dramatically. And that's the brand value difference. Now, you could turn it around and go to Houston, where Exxon is so strong, and Chevron would be the exact opposite. So a lot of it has to do with the customer loyalty, if you wish, and credit card saturation, where one company can set its price higher in this area but lower in another, okay? Now, BP Arco is a good example. BP Arco out here runs on the bottom end of the market with Arco brand, but runs on the top end of the market with BP and Amoco brand in the Midwest.
Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I'm wondering if you could summarize a final message for our listeners.
The biggest problem the public has to understanding this is to realize that there is no American oil. There are no American refineries. That implies that the public has a vested interest, and we don't. We gave all the oil on the public lands to the oil companies. We passed laws saying we wouldn't be in the refinery business, and we did this on the idea of saying it's a free enterprise system, we will rely on that, and we're one of the few countries in the world that have done that. So for years, got cheap energy back in return, and now we're not getting it any longer. So unfortunately, the old laws of the old days don't apply to these companies, and there is no American citizen alive that is entitled to a single drop of gasoline or diesel at any price. They're free to do what they want with it. They're free to charge what they want for it, 50 cents, $50, as long as they don't conspire. And that is the hardest part for people to understand, is that as long as they don't get caught in a smoke-filled room, they can do whatever they wish. And today, how you make money in the energy business is to sit down and coordinate with your suppliers or your competitors and intentionally short the market. And as long as they do so independently, even they know that they're all doing it, and don't meet in a smoke-filled room, it's legal.
I'm sorry, that begs one more question. What do you see as a solution then to this?
We sit down repeatedly and explain to members of the Washington State Legislature for a decade of where we were headed. An army of very well-heeled lobbyists with campaign contributions came right behind us and said it would never happen. Well, it's happened, and the cat's out of the bag. I don't know how we're going to get it back in. It would take a monumental effort by a state to go in and address this problem. It needs to be addressed on a federal level, and it's not going to be. It's that simple. People east of the Mississippi River and politicians don't give a rat's about the fact that people in the West are getting screwed. I mean, they don't care. So it's hard to get a national consensus, especially when a lot of the elected officials come from states like Texas and Oklahoma, who benefit dramatically from this flow of cash out of Washington and Oregon and California into their state economies. So the question is, what can the state legislature do? And one of the things it can do, quite honestly, is put these companies under commodity trading laws, which they're exempt from today. And the other thing is to go out and build a public reserve of gasoline. Go take some of these surplus tanks that are sitting around, buy them, pass an excess profit tax on the companies, use the money to fill the tanks up, and then when they start to jack the price, turn the gas loose so they can't get away with this. And that's something that the state can do. But you know, a lot of consumers gripe, but nobody ever goes to a legislature, very seldom, and says, do something about this or I'm going to hold you responsible in November. That doesn't happen. So because of that, there is right now, in my opinion, zero interest, and I mean that very clearly, zero interest in fighting with the oil lobby and in alienating them by going out and doing something about the high price of gasoline in Olympia. And it will stay that way until the public stops griping about the price at the pump and goes to the politicians at Olympia and says, do something about it. I'll help anybody who wants to get to the bottom of this. But like I say, there is zero, and I mean again, zero interest in Olympia to go up against the oil lobby. And we're talking about an economic drain on our economy today that so far exceeds anything the governor of this state legislature could ever begin to do. And it's not even on the list, no less prioritized. And there's only one reason for that, and that is the oil lobby is very powerful in Olympia, and his consumers don't hold them responsible.